Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the news that a federal regulator has left that job to join one of the entities he used to regulate is unsurprising. What might surprise you is the notion that that time-tested revolving door actually improves regulatory enforcement. Yes, it sounds strange to us, too. We'll hear about that from Michael Smallberg of the Project on Government Oversight. Also on the show, the popular public radio show This American Life has done reports recently on Guatemala's genocide in the 80s and Honduras' proposed charter cities, supposedly an answer to the economic privation, chaos, and violence in that country. But a fundamental fact was missing from both reports. We'll talk to Keen Bott, the manufacturing contempt blogger for the group NACLA, about what was left out of This American Life's Central America coverage. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Last week, news of the anticipation of the royal baby eclipsed much other news in the U.S., but it gave no indication of the level of stupid that would come with the kid's actual birth. But in a tough field where news outlets competed to provide torrents of inane coverage of an event that stopped being front-page news sometime around the Enlightenment, CNN appears to have won the sweepstakes. CNN put itself over the top when its correspondent, Victoria Arbiter, congratulated mom Kate Middleton, calling her brilliant not for giving birth, but for producing a male heir the first time out. "This is how brilliant a royal Kate is," Arbiter effused. Quote, "There are women throughout British royal family history who have panicked over not being able to deliver a boy, and here we are. Kate did it. First time." Close quote. No matter that a female child would be equally positioned to inherit the throne in the far, far future. Amidst CNN's torrential coverage, there was also a segment about childbirth in the UK featuring medical correspondent Elizabeth Cohen interviewing a British woman who was actually in labor, as well as a promo for a documentary special, Will and Kate Plus One. Elsewhere, MSNBC's Chris Matthews received honorable mention for complaining that coverage of New York mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner's latest online sexual weirdness was blotting out more important stories, including the birth of the Queen of England's great-grandchild. Quote, "This guy is going to be the big story of the night, not Trayvon Martin, not the princess having a baby, but this stuff." Close quote. Among the saturation coverage of the royal birth, one outlet provided relief. The Guardian's online site featured a Republican button, which, if pushed, hides all royal baby coverage from the reader. But that's in the UK. No such luck with US outlets.
The New York Times has not been covering the Bradley Manning trial in a regular, substantive way, and it shows. In a July 18th story on the military judge's decision not to acquit Manning of the charge of aiding the enemy, the paper wrote, quote, "The judge, Colonel Denise Lind, said the government had provided sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Private Manning knowingly gave information to certain enemy groups, like Al-Qaeda, when he passed hundreds of thousands of documents to WikiLeaks in 2009, close quote. Kevin Gastola of Fire Dog Lake has been covering the trial regularly and substantively. He wrote the paper pointing out that the piece seriously misrepresented the judge's ruling and that the events occurred in 2010, not 2009. The paper corrected the date. Gastola wrote them again, and finally, days later, the paper ran a proper correction, giving readers, those who saw it, the valuable information that the judge, quote, "did not find the evidence presented by the prosecution was sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Private Manning knowingly gave information to enemy groups like Al-Qaeda. Instead, according to her written ruling, she found that the evidence, viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution, without an evaluation of the credibility of witnesses, could reasonably tend to establish that the accused actually knew he was dealing with the enemy," close quote. And that was enough to justify keeping that charge alive. It's very good the Times corrected the error, and also hard not to note that they likely would never have made it had they, sent a reporter to cover the story.
All readers may not have seen the Times correction, but those who did could understand exactly the mistake the paper had made. That's how a correction is supposed to work. For a clear example of how it is not supposed to work, consider USA Today. We noted weeks ago that the paper had claimed, falsely, that Iran's new president-elect, Hassan Rouhani, was, quote, known for his negotiating skill over the country's nuclear weapons program, close quote. There is, in reality, no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. It is the consensus of U.S. intelligence agencies that they do not. FAIR issued an action alert, and on July 24th, the paper included a statement which read, quote, a June 17th story on Iranian President-elect Hassan Rouhani misstated his previous position. He was a negotiator over Iran's nuclear program, close quote. Readers would have no way of knowing what the paper's error might have been. Maybe they claimed he worked for a different government agency. The paper ran that item in a section labeled Corrections and Clarifications. Perhaps someone there should look into what those words mean.
One of the potentially hopeful outcomes of the Trayvon Martin-George Zimmerman case is increased scrutiny on the group ALEC, the shadowy corporate-funded group that works with allied lawmakers to introduce legislation like the Stand Your Ground law at the state level. MSNBC host Rachel Maddow went after ALEC on her July 18th broadcast, noting how the NRA had used the group to push Stand Your Ground through in Florida and elsewhere, and noting sharply how many of what she called the big mainstream corporate interests that belonged to ALEC had grown embarrassed at their association with the law and dropped out of the group. After all, Maddow asked, why on earth does Kraft Foods want a shoot first and ask questions later bill on its legislative agenda? And why would Pepsi be working on gun laws? Well, why indeed? But you know what would have made a neat addition to Maddow's argument? An acknowledgement that among the corporations evidently not embarrassed to be associated with ALEC is MSNBC owner Comcast. According to the Center for Media and Democracy, numerous Comcast executives serve as corporate co-chairs of ALEC in Georgia, Minnesota, Missouri, and Utah. Comcast is on ALEC's Communication and Technology Task Force and their Tax and Fiscal Policy Task Force. One Comcast executive received ALEC's State Chair of the Year Award in 2010. So why on earth does Comcast want a shoot first and ask questions later bill on its legislative agenda? Maddow could have investigated that one without leaving the building.
And finally, the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a story on July 22nd by Susan Fitzgerald that was widely picked up by other papers and social media. Crack baby study ends with unexpected but clear result, was the headline. The study, Fitzgerald wrote, asked, did cocaine harm the long-term development of children exposed to the drug in their mother's womb? And the story reported, quote, the researchers had expected the answer would be a resounding yes, but it wasn't. Another factor would prove far more critical, close quote. As one researcher says, quote, poverty is a more powerful influence on the outcome of inner city children than gestational exposure to cocaine, close quote. This is important information for people to know, but unexpected it isn't. This study only reconfirms what research has been telling us for a quarter of a century. As early as 1991, analysts were pointing to flaws in the initial mid-80s research that created the crack baby myth. The doctor whose limited study kicked off the hysteria in 1985 was warning that it had been badly misinterpreted by 1992. You know who didn't find the new study results unexpected? Susan Fitzgerald of The Inquirer. She wrote a piece for The Washington Post in 1997 looking at earlier results from the same research headlined, Crack Baby Fears May Have Been Overstated. Children of cocaine-abusing mothers are no worse off than others in urban poverty, study says. No doubt it's easier to sell a story as a shocking reversal of everything we used to know. But it serves no one to conceal just how long we've known the truth or to let media off the hook for creating and perpetuating those harmful myths for so long.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. You news that Robert Kusami, the former enforcement chief at the Securities and Exchange Commission, has left that job to join a corporate law firm that represents clients before the SEC certainly struck many as quintessentially dog bites man. The so-called revolving door between federal regulatory agencies and the entities they regulate is nothing new. What is rather new is that some have taken to describing the phenomenon not as regrettable but ineluctable, but as not a problem at all. In the New York Times July 24th Dealbook article, A Legal Bane of Wall Street Switches Sides, the paper says Kusami himself, quote, points to a study last year prepared by a group of accounting experts that found the revolving door actually toughened enforcement results, close quote. Come again. Joining us now to talk about the revolving door and its effects is Michael Smallberg, investigator at the Project on Government Oversight and the force behind the group's extensive work on the revolving door and particularly at the SEC. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Michael Smallberg.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Robert Kusami says, I learned from your work, that the revolving door is a myth perpetuated by critics armed with nothing but cynical assumptions and speculation. As well he might, one could say. What does your work suggest generally about this idea of regulatory capture as something that, while it might be intuitive, is not actually borne out?
So this is a debate that really goes back to the founding of the SEC. In fact, the first SEC chairman, Joseph Kennedy, was someone who was a suspected stock manipulator. And so some people were surprised when FDR appointed him to be the first head of the SEC. And when they asked him about this, FDR says, well, it takes a thief to catch a thief, essentially. If you want the government to have the expertise it needs to bring enforcement cases, you're going to have to, in many cases, bring people in who worked in the industry. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is that there are cases where a company that is really trying to skirt the law or is trying to minimize its liability when it's done something wrong will want to hire someone who not only has expertise in the securities issues, but also is going to know people who are currently at the agency because he or she used to work there. I think it more comes into play when we're looking at regulators identifying too much with the regulated. Sometimes there's a group thing at the SEC where they're not always considering their work through the lens of investors or shareholders or whistleblowers or the public at large. A lot of times they are looking at these issues through the perspective of big banks because that's where they came from and that's where they know they're going to go back to someday.
Well, let's talk about this study by academics released by the American Accounting Association that claims that the revolving door actually counterintuitively has positive impact on enforcement because, as I understand it, the official is being hired for his or her knowledge of the complex regulatory environment, as you've said, and they say he or she therefore has incentive to invest their human capital at the agency to increase their prospects, and so they're going to enforce regulations more and not less aggressively.
So this is a study that came out last summer. They found that when they looked at a certain subset of lawyers who had gone through the revolving door, they found that those lawyers actually appeared to have worked on more aggressive cases when they were at the SEC. One of the theories is they're making a bigger name for themselves on these high-profile cases that actually might make them more attractive to one of the top law firms that represents clients before the SEC. But we took a closer look at this study, and there are some serious limitations to what this study actually says. They were only looking at a narrow subset of enforcement lawyers and enforcement cases. So it's important to note they were not looking at all at SEC regulations. For example, the slew of regulations that the SEC is implementing to put the Dodd-Frank financial reforms into place, even though, of course, that's an area of serious concern when you have people who used to be at the agency and are now representing big industry groups that are trying to water down rules designed to protect the economy from another crisis. And also, they couldn't look at things like cases where the SEC didn't bring any charges at all because maybe a former official is representing a company that's under investigation and convinces the agency not to bring charges whatsoever. In the bigger picture, almost all of their settlements and enforcement actions actually end up returning very little money for investors, regardless of who's going through the revolving door. And these settlements are often very unsatisfactory because the companies often don't have to admit any sort of wrongdoing. A lot of times senior executives don't face charges. So this is where, again, for us, if you're looking for evidence of the revolving door, you're maybe not going to see, you know, corruption on a case-by-case level, but when you're stepping back and you're wondering, well, why does the SEC keep entering into these settlements that really don't provide much helpful information to the public, in some cases don't even stop companies from committing wrongdoing again in the future, that's where we worry sometimes that they're identifying too much with the lawyers and the people who work for these companies and are trying to get a break.
Well, finally, we hear in cases like Kusami's that the problems of conflict are mitigated by a cooling off period. And I've always wondered how something can be a conflict on December 31st and stop being one on January 1st. Are these really adequate measures to work against this climate, this culture of coziness that you're talking about?
These cooling off periods are a good start. We've actually called for an extension of cooling off periods, both for people who are leaving the agency and for people coming in, so that there's more of a distance between when they leave and when they come back representing a client. But there are very significant loopholes and limitations to these revolving door rules. For example, they often will not prevent someone from doing what we call behind-the-scenes lobbying. So Kusami personally cannot come back to the SEC in a couple of weeks representing a client, but he still might be able to provide advice to his colleagues at his new law firm or to their clients. He can tell them things like, here's the person you need to call to see what's going on with this enforcement case. Here are the types of arguments you need to make. Here are all these projects that we were working on while I was at the agency. So he can still provide really valuable advice, even if he personally isn't going through the revolving door. Those rules might prevent someone from switching sides quickly on an enforcement case, for example, but they don't necessarily apply to industry-wide regulations. If you were someone working on one of the Dodd-Frank rules, for example, there may not be that much that stops you from then actually leaving the SEC and going to lobby on behalf of a company that was affected by those rules, because the rules affected a bunch of companies and not just that one particular firm. I should also point out, you know, we're talking about Kusami leading the agency, so there is the revolving door in that direction. But another huge concern is people who come from industry to the SEC, because once they're in place, they often do have to end up recusing themselves from working on certain matters involving their former clients. A commissioner who used to represent Deutsche Bank or JP Morgan might be prevented from voting on an enforcement action against that company. So beyond just sort of an appearance of conflicts, there are very real ways in which the revolving door could limit the effectiveness of people at the agency and will make them less effective as a public servant.
We've been speaking with Michael Smallberg of the Project on Government Oversight. You can find their work on the revolving door and other issues online at pogo.org. Thanks again for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
When the popular public radio show This American Life devoted an hour to a massacre in Guatemala in 1982, at the height of that country's genocide against indigenous peoples, something important was missing from the story. Months later, when the show discussed how Honduras might address the rampant corruption, chaos, and violence that has increased there since a 2009 coup, the same thing was missing from that story. Joining me to talk about this is Keen Bott. He is the manufacturing contempt blogger for NACLA and the author of the current cover story in Fairs Magazine Extra. Welcome back to Counterspin, Keen Bott.
Delighted to be with you, Steve. Big fan of the show.
Well, now that listeners have been sufficiently teased, what was it that was missing from This American Life stories about Guatemala and Honduras?
The most shocking aspect of This American Life's coverage of both Honduras and Guatemala was the absolute, complete concealment of the United States' role in this genocide, as well as the ongoing political instability and turmoil in Honduras.
Let's talk a little bit more about Guatemala, which is the true focus of your story. I mean, the history of the United States involvement there goes back decades.
That's right. So This American Life is an extremely influential program. It reaches about 1.8 million listeners every episode and is routinely listed as one of the top podcasts in the United States. And it dedicated an entire hour to one particular act of the Guatemalan security force in 1982 in a small town called Dos Herres. But the larger context is that this is in a frame through which the Guatemalan military, through a string of different dictatorships, was launching a scorched earth campaign. So not only was it trying to attack a kind of a leftist insurgency, but also all of its civilian support mechanisms. That is to say, they were going about village by village and exterminating entire communities. And these military operatives were for decades being trained and armed by the United States. And not only that, but even when there were congressional bans on such U.S. support, the United States, through Ronald Reagan, they actually organized an entire campaign to funnel money through proxies like Israel and Taiwan and others. And so you had ongoing support, material participation through the height of the savagery that was taking place in the 1980s.
And you had Ronald Reagan, the so-called head of the free world, politically defending Rios Montt.
Absolutely. So on December 4th, 1982, just 2 days before these Guatemalan commandos would initiate their Dos Herres operation, Reagan addressed reporters at an Air Force base, and he said that he'd had a useful exchange of ideas with Rios Montt, and that he described him as a man of great personal integrity and commitment. And not only that, but he said that Rios Montt was receiving a bum rap from human rights groups and basically denied that Rios Montt and his military were engaging in atrocities. If you look at the declassified record, however, way back in 1979, the American Security Council, which later on ended up staffing Ronald Reagan's administration, they told the Guatemalan military that Reagan recognizes that a good deal of dirty work has to be done. And not only that, but the State Department even reported 9 days before Reagan made those statements that our embassy informed us of a new, well-founded allegation of large-scale killing of Indian men, women, and children. So this was a deliberate campaign by the Reagan administration to conceal the atrocities taking place in Guatemala. And unfortunately, This American Life, which is kind of a stalwart of the liberal intellectual class, is also concealing that very history.
In fact, it basically portrayed the U.S. as looking the other way or as being a bystander to it all.
Yes, that's the most insidious aspect of its reporting, was that it described the United States as standing by. And in fact, it was deliberately engaged, actively engaged in the height of the scorched earth campaigns that were taking place. And this kind of sleight of hand is absolutely important for maintaining an ideology which demands that the United States stop standing by in conflicts around the world and to engage more. So this kind of omission and then later on a kind of a false factual assertion about the United States as standing by gives legitimacy to campaigns which would involve the United States in military action to try to ameliorate humanitarian crises throughout the world. So this is a particularly dangerous form of reporting and journalism.
You know, erasing or disappearing the U.S. role in unsavory political activities around the world reminds me of back in 1990 when Nelson Mandela was released from prison after 27 years to a hero's welcome. But much of the U.S. press omitted that Mandela was initially captured because of a CIA trick.
Yeah, and the CIA in Guatemala was engaged in creating the largest surveillance and capturing program in Guatemala in the 1960s called Operación Limpieza. And through that, they were able to consolidate the kinds of brutal tactics employed by both the police and the military. And the military originally was engaged in dealing with foreign enemies. And in the 1960s, through United States participation, those forces, the military forces, were redirected against its own population. So this was setting the pace and the precedent for the atrocities that would occur in the 1980s.
Your NACLA colleague, Kevin Young, has done a piece looking more broadly at how the U.S. role is erased from events in the history of Latin America and Central America and Caribbean. But I wanted you to talk a little bit more about Honduras. We just have about a minute left.
That's right. And it also provides a kind of a point of continuity with This American Life, because This American Life provided an extremely laudatory portrayal of what was taking place in Honduras, which is a development scheme to institute what they call charter cities. These are cities that are owned and controlled by foreign investors, and they have autonomy, their own laws, their own police force, and so on. But what they didn't recognize and they didn't clarify for listeners is that the primary exponent of those charter cities is actually a coup mongerer and was actively engaged in legitimating a coup d'etat against a democratically elected president in 2009. So these development schemes that take place and that are imposed on the Honduran people would not be possible without the evisceration of the democratic systems that safeguard sovereignty within Honduras. So the constant turmoil and the political instability and the murders that are constantly taking place enacted by the police and the military in Honduras are a reflection of this U.S.-backed military coup regime that came into power and the constant aid, support, and training that continues to this day.
Amazing. We've been speaking with Keen Bott, the manufacturing contempt blogger for NACLA and the author of the current extra cover story on This American Life and Guatemala's genocide. Stay tuned for more information about Extra. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin, Keen Bott.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.